Broadcasting to New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, Sydney, London, and around the world, this is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live, 101.3 KPCG. A new study shows how the media treats the current president. I don't think you'll be surprised, but some interesting numbers. The technology is being used in criminal trials and investigations. The question is, how legal is it? We'll take a look at that. Five authoritarian regimes that shape Facebook's censorship policies. You'll find that interesting. Also, some history of the Korean War in light of what North Korea is doing now. That and more on this weekend edition of Trumpet Radio Live.
This is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live, this weekend edition on 101.3 KPCG, online at kpcg.fm, live link at thetrumpet.com. If you'd like to follow us on Twitter, you can do that at kpcgfm, and also email us comments at kpcg.fm. Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon, and Abraham Blondo here today. All of us survived a stormy day yesterday, several tornadoes in Oklahoma, nothing too close to our area. Pretty windy down in Norman, which for those who are not from this area, that's to the south, about, what, 20 miles or so. They had about 80-mile-an-hour straight-line winds. We had a lot of hail, of rain, lightning, just a good old May thunderstorm, severe weather day and evening in Oklahoma.
Yeah, it's always nice sleeping during a heavy rain, but obviously it seemed like the storms avoided where we are, so we didn't have to deal with anything other than rain, really.
Yeah, it was a good, just a good old-fashioned thunderstorm, I guess, for us right here, thankfully, and we didn't have the tornadoes. But hail came through about 1 in the morning or so, and I woke up and then I kind of drifted in and out of sleep. And I kept having these odd dreams. I was half awake and half sleeping. And I had these dreams that my roof was collapsing, this whole scenario playing out. I was thinking about my roof and if I'm going to need to have it looked at, because you know, every time you get a lot of hail, you have that happen. And so anyway, it was kind of I think they call those fever dreams, though I didn't have a fever. But I was just, I was in and out of consciousness and kind of making stuff up on the fly. My mind was, according to the sounds.
Oh, kind of like what I'm doing on the radio show now.
That's right.
Just kidding. But I was like big rainstorms because my driveway, it points my truck the wrong direction, so water builds up in the bed. And so when I drive to go to work early in the morning, there's this huge waterfall at the back of my truck for the first few, about 20 feet.
Yeah. You should charge your neighbors. You're like the street cleaner.
Yeah, exactly.
Drive through and wash off the street. Abraham, you had a poll that you were conducting over the last few days on whether or not, it says this. Do you think that President Trump should be impeached? That's been in the media, in the news, and you've got the results for us. What are the results?
Yeah, I thought this was really interesting, and it was pretty popular. We had 190 people vote on it, so it was quite a few. And the results are 62% think no, the president should not be impeached, and 38% said yes. And I do have a number of comments, and it just is interesting because most of them are very vehement at saying that the president shouldn't be impeached and that it's the media is making up a false narrative, trying to take him down. And here are just some comments here. This is from Barry Wyman. And he says, apart from media mischief, I can't believe anyone without an axe to grind believes this Russian insanity. Chrissy Mega 22 says, media mischief is being too nice. Media crimes is more like it. They cover up, omit, and deceive the American people. And then #save net neutrality. He says, the closer we get to Trump impeachment, the closer we get to Mike Pence becoming president and Dems losing even more in 2018-2020.
Yeah, interesting comments. A lot of them focused on the media. And there's a study that's been conducted. Heat Street featured this. And basically, they looked at a few things in relation to how the media is covering the current president. We talked about that yesterday somewhat. And I don't think anyone's going to be surprised to find out the coverage is extremely negative. But and I don't know exactly where they come up with their numbers, but at least it is a study they conducted. U.S. news outlets, tone of news coverage, CNN, 93% negative, 7% positive. NBC, same, 93% negative. CBS, 91% negative. New York Times, 87% negative. Washington Post, looks like about 83% negative. Wall Street Journal, 70% negative. Fox, 52% negative. Even Fox is a little more on the negative side.
That's pretty fair and balanced, isn't it?
Well, it is, really, yeah. I mean, if you look at it. European news outlets, ARD, is 98% negative. Financial Times, 84% negative. And BBC, 74% negative. So it is mostly negative. The tone of the news coverage, according to this study, on specific topics. Immigration, 96% negative. Healthcare, 87% negative. Russia and the election, 87% negative. International trade, 84% negative. Personal background on the president, 82% negative. Other foreign defense, personal. Fitness for office, all 82 and 81% negative. Terrorist threat, 70% negative. Other domestic issues, 72% negative. Economy, 54% negative. Because the economy has had a few positives, maybe. Other topics, 82% negative. And in relation to that, there's a really good example of that, one of these websites. I won't mention which news source it is. But they have an article today talking about MS-13, that very violent gang. It was talked about on the Trumpet Hour program, I think, on Wednesday. Andrew Miller talked about that. And the president said that, according to them, that this website here, that MS-13 has, quote, literally taken over towns and cities of the U.S. So that's their article. Oh, have they? And so here are just the big headers for their article. Origin of MS-13, not imported and not new. Connection to immigration, difficult to assess. Reach in the U.S., fraction of total gang problem. So their whole tone is, oh, it's not that big of a deal. You mean to tell me MS-13 is not that big of a deal? I mean, that's what they're getting at. Oh, it's not that big of a deal. You want to tell that to the people that have had their kids murdered? That just shows you the tone. No matter what is said, even when it's beyond dispute, it's a bad problem, it needs to be solved, they still come in and say, it's not that big of a deal.
Well, haven't there been numerous stories about people just hiding in their homes, afraid to go outside because of MS-13 roaming the streets?
Yeah.
It would seem like MS-13 has taken over those towns.
And you know what's amazing is that news site that I won't mention, this article. They had an article on their same site a couple months ago talking about how one, I think it was New Jersey town, was being just absolutely destroyed by MS-13. Same news source. But now they've changed their tone. It's exactly the same as what happened with the firing of Comey, right? They all wanted him gone until the current president fired him. Then nobody wants him gone. This is just flip-flopping based upon whatever. They just want to see the current administration fail.
Yeah, I think what's interesting from all those statistics on the positive or negative feedback, I don't think there was one on the military or on that sort of thing, because I think that would be overwhelmingly positive. This morning I listened to an interview by Victor Davis Hanson. He's a Hoover Institute member, and he just said that despite all the negative press the president gets, his tax reform has been overwhelmingly positive, the reviews of it. Most of his appointments have been positive. In the high offices, they haven't been failures. He's done a lot. Replace Obamacare.
Potentially.
At least they got the first votes passed on it. And he's done a lot so far that any other president in the first 100 days would probably be applauded for. But all those are being swept under the rug, and it's you just have these huge stories about how he's colluding with the Russians or how he's always saying the wrong thing, how he's always making up his own stories, all that sort of thing. And just a total misrepresentation of the facts, but also it's, as we've talked about before, it's undermining your own government to solve the problems. if the president is handcuffed by the media, he can't protect people from MS-13 and all these other problems.
Right. One last thing here from this study that Heat Street featured. The tone of coverage for the past few presidents. President Clinton, he had 60% negative coverage, in the according to them. G.W. Bush, 57% negative. President Obama, 41% negative. He had 59% positive reviews, mostly. And then President Trump's been 80% negative. So he's been they've been the harshest on him to this point. Every one of the last four has had mostly negative coverage, although it's been, you know, pretty close to half and half, until you get to President Obama, who had 59% positive. So is that based on, say, what each one did? Not necessarily, maybe to some extent, but mostly it's based upon just the way the media feels about them. It's a lot of power.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's amazing how much the media shapes people's voting intentions or can turn voters against someone. I think that's what we saw in the last election. But also, if you do view it based off of what each president did, every president makes mistakes. Everyone makes controversial decisions. But if you look at where America was in 2008 and where we are today, there's enough statistics to show that the media was not fair during President Obama's presidency in showing mistakes, scandals, and how America became so weak that President Trump now has to make huge controversial moves to try to regain everything lost in those 8 years.
Yeah. Interesting times in which we live, and I don't think it'll get more positive heading down the down the road.
Well, even with former President Clinton, he was 60% negative, but if he had not been impeached, he would have been down there in the low 40s as well. I mean, it was almost like the media was dragged into covering him negatively because the president had been impeached. They liked him too.
Yeah. And he was a likable guy, you know. A lot of times you do get some presidents that they have a real knack for being likable. But then in some cases you get some that just are not likable, but somehow they pull the wool over the eyes.
I wonder what those stats would be like for Ross Perot.
Can I finish? That's a hearken. If you can hearken back to those times, you'll get that reference. Here's an interesting thing that's coming up in the criminal justice system. Technology is changing, and so the way criminals are being apprehended is changing as well. But there's a question into the legality of using some of the information they gather. This is from Time Magazine. It says, Alexa takes the stand. You're familiar with the Alexa device. You ask, it's that little tower thing. You ask it questions. Listening devices raise privacy issues. And so what's happening is our lives are surrounded by microphones on our phones, if we have an Alexa or something like that, or a device that uses that. And so the question becomes, if it records you doing something that you shouldn't be doing, is it admissible in court? Thoughts before we get into this?
Well, I think if the information is attained through a warrant or other established means of getting evidence that there already is, then yes. It just depends on the circumstances, I guess. But I think they would have to make a new set of rules on how that kind of information can be attained in the first place by law enforcement if they're listening to it without the other person knowing, or if they get a tip and then they go take the information with a warrant and then use it. I think that would be the best way.
Well, there's some interesting legalities here. This case they're talking about, this gentleman by the name of Victor Collins was found dead. That was in November 2015 at his supposed friend's place, James Bates. Police were quick to suspect foul play based upon some physical evidence. They say some of the most crucial evidence was gleaned not only from the crime scene, but from an array of internet-connected devices in Bates' home. Data from his smart utility meter, for example, indicated that someone had used 140 gallons of water between 1 a.m. and 3 a.m. And they think he hosed off his deck, I guess. There was some crime scene stuff there. The records from Bates' iPhone 6S Plus, which required a passcode or fingerprint to unlock, suggested he had made phone calls long after he told police he'd gone to sleep. So they caught him with that. And audio files captured by Bates Echo, Amazon's popular personal assistant that answers to Alexa, promised to offer police a rare window into Bates' living room the night that Collins died. So this case is going to trial in July, and they're trying to figure out what they can use, what's admissible in the trial. And they say the case is going to be the first time ever that data recorded by an Echo or any other artificial intelligence-powered device like Google's Home or Samsung Smart TV will be submitted as evidence in court. The move has alarmed tech analysts and privacy advocates nationwide. The issue is not only that these new devices are equipped with so-called smart microphones, and unless you manually disable them, they are always on, listening for a wake word like Alexa or Hey Siri. It is also microphones live in our most intimate spaces, in our living rooms, kitchens, bedside tables. In a world in which these personal assistants are always listening for our voices and recording our requests, have we given up on any expectation of privacy within our homes? And so here's where the law comes in. U.S. privacy laws, as they have been interpreted over the past 40 years, offer no clear guidance on how to deal with these shiny new gadgets. The Fourth Amendment, along with a host of state and federal privacy statutes, has traditionally provided citizens with a powerful right to privacy within their own homes, the exception being third-party doctrine, where you told somebody something or you made a phone call, and then it's admissible potentially. So if you ask Siri something, is that a third-party situation? That's the question.
Yeah, that's a really tough situation, and it's almost like it would be nice to judge it on a case-by-case basis. I mean, it really looks like something evil happened in this situation, and if the ability to convict him is staring you right in the face, it would be pretty sad if you couldn't use the Alexa data to figure out for sure if he did it. But there's a lot of other situations where privacy could be breached just because the government might have it out for you a little bit. And that's why, even if you had it on a case-by-case basis, it would be up to the people in charge to judge it properly on a case-by-case basis, and you can't really trust that that would be the case.
It's the old Big Brother thing, you know, Russia, right? Who's listening? Who's watching you? They say the issue is further complicated by the nature of spoken interactions. If your iPhone mistakenly hears, "Hey Siri," when you say, "They seriously," you did not intend to interact with a third party, much less to create a record of your conversation. But nonetheless, it's there, transmitted, and saved. So they're going to start splitting hairs now over, did you say, "Hey Siri," or "They seriously?" And that could be the difference between conviction and not conviction.
Yeah, well, I think criminals who don't want to be surveillance won't buy these devices. I mean, if you're involved in illegal activity, if you murdered your friend or something like that, it's just foolish to have something like this around anyway. I think if you have nothing to hide, then it's not a big deal. If you have nothing to hide, then so what if all your conversations are recorded? Now, I'm not saying that they should be able to have everything in your house. There is a right to privacy, but at the same time, if these devices are such a invasion of privacy, then we shouldn't have them in the first place, because then it creates these legal conundrums that leave the law system with deciding one way or the other. That's the way the American law system works, unfortunately, especially if this goes to the Supreme Court, is they have to make a judgment on what the Constitution says, and that's the judgment until it's overruled or repealed or something. So I don't know, just I think it brings up interesting case on if this technology should exist anyway, but also if you did do something wrong, then it's your own fault, kind of.
Yeah, I see what you're saying, but I do sort of disagree. I to the point where I just feel like it's private and it shouldn't. You know, in this case they cite here in this Time article, there's plenty of physical evidence to convict the guy for doing something wrong. But I don't want people, you know, out of everything you've ever said, you know, who's going to say, yeah, go ahead and read it back. There won't be, you won't find one thing. You know, everybody's got something that you, oh, I shouldn't have said that or shouldn't have done that. And it's like that, kind of like that movie. What was that movie? Minority Report. Was that what it was? Where they would like predict crime?
Yes.
Is that what it was? Yeah. It's not quite like that, but it almost is. Like, hey, we're just going to poke around in this person's business until we find something. And if you have access to all that data, which the NSA, that's been a big, you know, thing, you may find something. Or even if you don't, you could make it look like something. And that's where I think the danger comes in.
Well, that's exactly the issue. Not every situation is going to be a murder. And so even if we think we haven't done anything wrong, that doesn't mean the government agrees that we haven't done anything wrong, or they might not try to prosecute us for possibly having a different viewpoint. I mean, we've even seen the IRS targeting conservative groups before. So even if the viewpoints differ from what the government would have us to believe, then they could then start searching through data to find something else that they wouldn't, or that they wouldn't like, or that maybe they could win in court with.
Yeah. It's like anything, I suppose. If the person making the decision at the top is just, then you probably have nothing to worry about.
Exactly.
But you're not going to get that very often. There's always going to be something there. So it is just it's just an interesting time. It's a changing time. And to your point, Abraham, I mean, if you are living above board, probably won't be a problem. But still, it is. It's just an interesting world. No one would want to live in a glass house where people are watching everything you do and listening to everything you say always. That's just an unnerving feeling.
Yeah. Well, I think to add to my point, just that the only way the police or the government could have access to that is if they can justify that it would lead to a prosecution, or that it's absolutely essential to the case. Otherwise, then they shouldn't need it. Like it should be under some kind of more strict regulation that it only can be attained if it's very, very important to their case or something like that. Otherwise, they shouldn't be listened to all the time, just when perhaps it's needed to show evidence of something that happened. I don't know though. I think for most circumstances they wouldn't need it anyway, because if you can convict someone, you probably don't need the data on one of those machines.
Well, it is amazing how there have been some cases that have come up over the last few years where a person got caught and convicted of something, and they went back and looked at their Google searches,
right,
and they Googled the exact thing they were going to do, like, yeah. How do you enter the crime? So it is, you would think people wouldn't do that, but a lot of times they do. And so it the more the technology changes, it just opens up more questions. So that's going to trial, I think they said, in July. So there'll be a precedent set of some kind. So anyway, interesting. One other technology note that's kind of interesting here. You guys know the circus is leaving town for good, of course. The last act. After 146 years, the circus is taken off. They're not going to have those anymore. I suppose they might have them in certain places, but some of the bigger ones are stopping. They say in this write-up here, though it might sound quaint, there was a time when people could be astonished. And that's what's being lost. You know, you used to, hey, the circus is coming to town. That was quite a big deal. And they have one interesting paragraph here. It says, now our supply of stimulation is infinite, and our capacity for wonder is dwindling away. Entertainment is on demand. Nostalgic parents have been struggling for a couple of decades to hide their disappointment from their children after seeing what the circus has become. Not quite what it used to be, I guess. You guys ever been to the circus, by the way?
No.
Yes, years ago.
Yeah.
I thought it was really entertaining. But I think we all know those people who, no matter how incredible the thing in front of us is, they say, oh, I did that in my backyard. That's not even impressive at all.
Right.
So there are some people who just cannot be thrilled no matter what it is.
Well, they said that obviously they had to try to change the way they did the circus because of the changing attention spans, and it kind of took away from the overall effect. But also, they say, meanwhile, and this is a really interesting point, meanwhile, the children have been struggling to understand why their parents would care about the circus. Nothing can compete with the circus that they hold in the palms of their hands, which is their smart device. And that's interesting because constant stimulation, or the ability to have it, it does take away your sense of wonder and your sense of awe and your sense of excitement over things. So we're gaining this world of information on demand, but what are we losing? That's the question.
Yeah, it's like when everything stands out, we almost react to everything with a yawn. Nothing really stands out if it's all amazing at the same time. If you can access whatever you want to every second of the day, then what makes a certain event special anymore, such as the circus?
Yeah, there's as a kid, we used to go to the fair once a year. That was kind of a big deal, and that was exciting. You'd look forward to it for a week or so ahead of time. And but now I don't know. I don't know if people would be as excited about those things because, like they say, depending on what you let your kids do, they've got the whole world in their hand. Because you see that, and we've talked about that before. You go to a professional sporting contest. Well, that's exciting. I mean, man, here you are watching these professional players. And you've got a whole group of people, a lot of times, are just sitting there looking at their phones.
Courtside, too.
Yeah.
They're literal feet away from these superhero athletes, and they spend the whole game on their phone.
Yeah, it's stunning.
Yeah, you can't do it in the hockey game because beer will get spilled over it.
Get a puck in the face.
Yeah. Can't do it in Lambo because your phone will freeze to your hand.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I think it brings up a good point, just that we're at a point now, because the circus, if it came to your town and you went to it, you saw things you probably haven't seen before or you very rarely were able to see. Today, you can see anything you want on your phone, or zoos are much more common and those sorts of things where these exotic animals are more commonplace, I guess, than they used to be. But also, it's a good point just that I think kids are more interested in playing video games, looking at other people's Instagram pictures, watching people on a video do something than actually experience it themselves. Mm-hmm. And it seems like that's a stimuli that a lot of young people go after. And as the article makes a good point, it's destroying their initiative to experience things themselves and just appreciate the natural world around them.
Well, and I think it destroys imagination. You don't have to imagine. You know, you it's all right there for you. It's kind of like the news we were talking about yesterday. There's so much news, you don't even have to really formulate a thought. Mm-hmm. You just let it dump into your head. And then move on to the next thing. And I think we talked a while ago about, I think it was a write-up along those same lines where sometimes young people or old people alike, I guess, they're not interested in going out and living life. They'd rather watch somebody else live it on a show or mm-hmm. on some video on the internet.
Well, isn't that what happens when kids are raised on the screen? They don't realize that the screen is nothing but a poor substitute for actually going out and experiencing those types of events in person. I mean, at least for us, we got screens a little bit later on probably, and so we have actually experienced some of those events live. It's way better in person. It's way better to go outside of the house and actually accomplish something than it is to watch it on the screen.
The one exception from my childhood was playing the archaic game Oregon Trail,
yes,
where they died all the time.
You don't want to experience that one in person.
I did not want to experience the death from malaria or whatever it was on the way to
Oregon.
You have
cholera.
I remember playing that on, my brother had a graphing calculator and he had a bunch of video games like Mario and different things on it. And one of them was Oregon Trail. Mm-hmm. And no matter what I did, I always died from dysentery or something like that.
That's right.
Or got all my cow died fording a river. And I was like, come on, like how are you supposed to do this?
Very hard, very hard. I one time, just as a test, I ran the people at the hardest pace and with no food.
Oh, wow.
And they still lived for like 2 or 3 weeks. I'm like, how is that possible? This is not an accurate depiction of human life.
Is it cholera or cholera? I think it's probably cholera.
Cholera.
I said it wrong. Sorry.
Well, when you got it, it doesn't matter how you say it. It's a bad deal.
We all knew what you meant.
Yeah. One other note here is kind of interesting. For those of you who might like to watch a documentary from time to time, there's a new one out. New one out is called The Art of Obit, A Life in 800 Words. It says, when a famous person dies, reading a well-written obituary can provide a therapeutic farewell to someone whose life and work touched us. And so they have this write-up about some of the people that have done that over the years, or it's a documentary about them. Writing an evocative, compact, accurate obituary is an art, and Vanessa Gould's joyous documentary, Obit, takes us on a tour of the joint where some of the best are written, the obituaries desk of the New York Times. How do you capture the essence of a life in 800 words? Tops, generally in just a few hours. Gould interviews a number of Times reporters who spend their days telling us about the recently deceased, including ace obit writer Margalit Fox. She sums up why these posthumous mini-bios matter and why they're not inherently depressing. She says obits have next to nothing to do with death and, in fact, absolutely everything to do with life. That would be a challenge to write a good obituary, you know, especially they're famous people usually. In 800 words or less, you've got to sum up what they did. So that might be kind of interesting to look at.
That is what makes a good obituary stand out. It does have to focus on life and, experiences instead of the circumstances surrounding the death or what the funeral was like. That's not really what anyone wants to focus on because, you know, everyone dies, but what does the person's life really have to it that makes it stand out?
Yeah, that would be a real challenge.
What's interesting, actually, is my mom's father's brother, my great-granddad's brother, my granddad's brother, I should say, when he died in the obituary, it said he landed on Normandy, on Juno Beach, and no one ever knew about it.
Really?
People knew he went to war, but he never talked about it. And so that's the only written proof we have of it right now, besides if we ordered his military records or something. But most of the family members have died. And he never talked about his experiences from the war, so people didn't really know about it. He was older than my granddad as well, so my granddad didn't remember too much from his childhood. So anyway, I have that scanned on my computer, and that's the only written link we have to that history of our family.
That's interesting. Yeah, situations like that, obviously, a lot of times people don't want to talk about them.
Yeah,
but that's true of a lot of people, whether they're. You know, sometimes people have done amazing things and they just never talk about it. And you don't know and then until you read it later. So that's pretty fascinating. It'd be an interesting documentary. You're listening to Trumpet Radio Live here on 101.3 KPCG. The Key of David program's coming up in a bit. Also, the Trumpet Daily Radio Show with your host, Stephen Fleury. Trumpet Hour Week in Review program also. And stop and check out thetrumpet.com. Top story, featured story, Women Wanted for America's Masculine Trades. Grunt work has hiring gaps to fill, and here's why females are in its sights. That's by Christopher Eames. Related to that, two write-ups, The Incredible Shrinking Man. Sounds like a superhero, but it's not. And Biblical Manhood. You can check those out at thetrumpet.com. Ant-Man, right? He gets really small.
That is a fantastic superhero movie.
But he still is really strong.
And he gets really big, too, apparently.
Oh.
In the Marvel, or in the Avengers movie. Mm.
I see. Well, this isn't about that. but it does sound like a superhero. Grant, you've got a good write-up for us here from Breitbart. 5 authoritarian regimes that shape Facebook's censorship policies.
Yes, this is not your typical BuzzFeed piece that just has all these hypotheticals. This is literally Facebook going to these different countries' governments and trying to work out how they can expand into those markets while still keeping to those authoritarian countries' censorship policies as well.
Oh, very interesting. I guess they'd have to consider that because they want to expand their market and their base, yet China's not going to let you just do whatever you want or other nations like that. Interesting.
Right. Facebook already has hundreds of millions of users, but of course, there are 7 billion people on Earth. Probably, I would still think less than half have internet access, but there's still a couple billion more, at least, who they could reach. But they have to enter into places like China and Russia. That's the issue there. And so they really are going above and beyond to try to reach into these areas. The CEO, Mark Zuckerberg, had a meeting in China, and he actually delivered speeches in Chinese during multiple trips to that nation. And then he also even asked the Chinese president to name his child, name Mark Zuckerberg's child, although the Chinese president refused.
Yeah, that's a weird request.
Seemed like he was
Bob
trying to butter him up a little bit.
Yeah, that's a really interesting request. I guess the question, would sort of become, do these authoritarian regimes now, their censorship policies, do those start to bleed over into the way Facebook is used in the United States?
It looks like it because the last part of this segment about China here talks about Chinese social networks priding themselves on blocking what they call fake news. So for Facebook to be able to compete, they must also block fake news or else it won't even be allowed in the country. They have to try to usurp a lot of the usership of these other local social media networks.
Mm. Yeah, it's interesting. Of course, fake news is talked about in Europe as well. But even if you think about, say, just the way history is reported or talked about, it's different in every nation to a point. And so some of what we would teach as history in the U.S., probably about World War II, I would think they would have a different take on it. So, you know, facts aren't necessarily facts globally. They're not accepted everywhere. But you're trying to have this sort of global network. You're on Facebook, and so you have to do this awkward dance of what do you allow, what don't you allow.
Oh, well, it just reminds me of something I just read last night about the North Korean leaders and the Chinese, that their censorship program goes back 70 years or more, whenever the communists took over. And so the leaders today, it's doubtful they can even find the truth if they wanted it, because either they would be banned from doing it because it would be against the Communist Party, or this, it doesn't exist anymore because it's been so censored for 70 years. So it's just interesting that if you have this network, internet network around the world, where you have all these different viewpoints merging on one place, how do you stop, or how do you preserve those cultural viewpoints? Some of them are very belligerent, like China. America's are a little different, a little more flexible. But how do you preserve those when, for those countries, it's really a matter of life and death? If you do something wrong, you can be put in jail or just disappear, like some people have. So it is a risky business.
That's true. How would you feel if you were working there at Facebook, or you were high up like Zuckerberg, and people are getting killed because of something they put on your platform in a regime like that? That's an interesting moral question.
Right, and a lot of Facebook employees have quit because it seems like Facebook is trying to develop a tool that will help them block certain content in certain nations. And the thing is, we've also heard a lot of people in America trying to talk about how they need to block fake news. If we start doing that for the next 70 years, then American history will also disappear, like Abraham was talking about. And that's a big problem, because no nation has the type of history that America does. It is a special sort of God-inspired history that no other nation could really relate to. But there is a big push to try to undermine history today.
Yeah, and those different authoritarian regimes, most of their media is state-sponsored media, and it's all propaganda. Most of it is fake to a major extent. I don't think he's trying to get into North Korea, but if he was, well, you know what North Korea says. We'll talk about that in a little bit. They hate the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
So, and they say that we're the cause of all kinds of problems and everything, and it's mostly, well, it's all fake, but yet there it's considered true. So, right. You know, how are you measuring fake? That's the thing. Once you get away from an absolute truth, everything gets murky, and so you've got a company like this, like Facebook, trying to figure out what to censor and what not to. It's kind of almost like a God prerogative, and that's pretty dangerous.
Well, at that point, fake news just comes down to whatever Facebook personally disagrees with, and it's been proven that they lean left, so they're going to be censoring a lot of conservatives.
Yeah, there's all kinds of talk because they want to change rules about the internet and so forth, and banning. I mean, they've already done some things, haven't they? I haven't looked at it too closely. I don't spend really any time on Facebook, but some people have been, like, marked as being fake or something to that effect. I think I've read some things about that. YouTube is, the advertisers have changed the way they respond to YouTube based upon whether they like the videos or not. So this whole world is this world of information is changing, and a lot of it has to do with censorship and what side of the aisle you're on, I guess.
Right. A lot of conservative users of Facebook have talked about how certain posts have been demonetized, or they have to spend way too much money to get their post out in front of maybe a few hundred, maybe a few thousand people, and yet they're spending thousands of money just to reach a few thousand, or thousands of dollars just to reach a few thousand people. So that's not the case for all Facebook users, but certain ones have had an extremely difficult time trying to use the platform for their careers.
And it's hard because if a major company like Facebook just decides they don't want you to get your message out there, what are you going to do about it?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you'd have to go somewhere else. There's no one to appeal to, I don't think. I mean, maybe there could be some lawsuit or something, but it would be a real uphill battle and, of course, an expensive one. And they've got deep pockets, and I'm sure the people trying to post don't. So it's tough. It's tough to get out there and for people to get their message out. Or it seems like it's getting harder potentially unless it fits into what the popular thought is.
That's what's so difficult, too, for anyone using Facebook. Most of them do not have the resources to fight back. And technically, Facebook could, I think they could censor whoever they want to. It just isn't really American, and there aren't really a whole lot of alternatives for people to use right now because Facebook is by far the biggest outlet. So that really does provide quite a conundrum for a lot of users who have experienced censorship on that platform. So Facebook did go into China. They did really do a couple of bizarre things to try to reach out to China and really try to get more viewership on their platform instead of on these local platforms. They've also tried to go into Turkey, which frequently censors its own citizens on the internet. They've blocked out all social media across the country before, and even just last month they blocked access to Wikipedia. So this is another country that Facebook is trying to get into, but even there in Turkey they've censored the Kurds who have been fighting the Islamic State, just because, or that's what Turkey wants to happen. They want the Kurds to be censored even though they fight the Islamic State. And that's a pretty difficult situation to get around as well. That they've also tried to get into Pakistan, but Pakistan has sent out a text to millions of their own people urging fellow citizens to report each other if they find any sort of blasphemous post on social media. Those are some difficult countries to try to reach out to when that's how the government is treating its own people.
Can you imagine getting a text from your country?
Right.
You know, oh, I just got texted from the U.S. I mean, it doesn't really happen here. But I guess it does there.
Yeah. It really is strange and something we could never even begin to understand. But they have many times tried to stone their own people there in Pakistan for supposedly speaking blasphemy. Doesn't seem like a free market of ideas over there if that's where Facebook wants to go.
Yeah, that's what's interesting, because it is a very liberal environment here in the U.S. for the most part, and some of these companies are very liberal, I guess, depending on how you would define that. But yet they're trying to get into countries that are the exact opposite.
Right.
And so it is just a strange. I know obviously they're looking at money. They want to make money by getting into these countries, but it's kind of like what happened, I think, to some extent with, say, the last administration, where we would go around and sort of bow to these other nations and, you know, tell us how you do things and, you know, all this. Where really we're supposed to, we had been the leaders in the world, and others would come to us to see how we did things. Mm-hmm. And now it's sort of changing, and it's not a good change.
Well, I think it's interesting, too, is that the potential for this, and it looks like the only way Facebook can go into business is in those countries is by becoming complicit with the authoritarian regime's propaganda machine. In Pakistan, Facebook would have to be complicit with Sharia law, imposing anti-women, very authoritarian regime against human rights. Same thing in China, same thing in Turkey. So it's a weird dichotomy, I think, because obviously Facebook wants to make money, and I think they just want to connect more people around the world too, I imagine. However, by doing that, you're actually strengthening the regime's grip on people, and you're also pinpointing people who have a independent spirit and who actually are against those types of governments. You're probably exposing them to more danger than before. So it is interesting. Should Facebook, an American corporation, be able to go into those countries and be forced to basically conform to those regimes' anti-American, anti-Western, anti-Christian way of doing things? That's just an interesting conundrum.
Yeah, they sort of become a branch of the government in those nations. And really, and I know we do this, or we have done this, but it's like selling weapons to those nations.
Mm-hmm.
You're like, it's like one of our weapons manufacturers making, you know, weapons for Turkey or whoever. And I know we've sold arms and that type of thing, but there's a lot of interesting questions about that.
Yeah, and there already does seem to be some evidence that Facebook has been helping some of these governments. There in Pakistan, the government has already claimed that Facebook has helped them remove 85% of all blasphemous material from its platform. at least from users within the country. So that does show you that Facebook is willing to do whatever it takes to expand its presence in some of these areas or to break into some of these areas, like in China. The fourth area is Russia. So after China, Turkey, and Pakistan, this article is talking about how Facebook is trying to get into Russia. And Facebook did actually a few years ago block a page supporting Alexei Navalny, described by the Washington Post as Putin's biggest critic. So they blocked a page supporting him. It seems like Facebook was doing the bidding of the Russians there, even though all of our focus seems to be on Mr. Trump colluding with them.
Right. And there was five. What was the fifth one that he went to?
The fifth one's actually Germany and the European Union. So this is a more Western group of nations, and yet Facebook has been helping them as well. There was an overheard conversation where Angela Merkel was overheard asking Mark Zuckerberg if he was actually working to clamp down on supposedly hateful material. Mark Zuckerberg personally is a big fan of their crazy migration policy, and he's actually urged America to do the same thing. So he's right on board with the government in that case, and it's almost like Germany and the European Union want to try to change the definition of hate speech so that basically if you speak against the common belief there, then you're in trouble.
Yeah. Really an interesting, fascinating thing. So much technology and so much changing. You can read more about that at Breitbart. Five authoritarian regimes that shape Facebook's censorship policies. There's a lot to think about there. One other note that we have time to get to today. This is in relation, Abraham, to the Korean War. Yesterday, we talked a little bit about this Washington Post article. The title is, Why Does North Korea Hate the United States? Let's go back to the Korean War. And this little paragraph to set you up here for what you have to say. Or a couple paragraphs. This write-up from the Washington Post says, kindergartens and childcare centers in North Korea are decorated with animals holding grenades and machine guns. Cartoons show plucky squirrel soldiers, North Koreans, triumphing over the cunning wolves, the Americans. North Koreans live in a war mentality, and this is anti-American propaganda. It's wartime propaganda. The thing is, they say, there is some element of truth to the North Korean version of events. It's only a kernel, and it's grossly exaggerated, but North Koreans remember very well what most Americans have forgotten or never knew, that the Korean War was a brutal one. They're trying to justify the regime based upon the Korean War.
Yeah, this article continues to anger me a great deal, and I encourage the listeners to go through, read the whole thing, and then go read a book about the Korean War, because you'll find that... it's much, much different.
Just one book. That's all it would take.
Yeah. And if you go through, she goes through the history of the Korean War in a very brief manner. And I think she misinterprets the facts. And the main point she makes is that majority killed during the war were Koreans, around 3 million Koreans dead. She didn't say how most of them died. And then she blames it a lot of it is because of the U.S. air campaign. The amount of bombs we dropped on Korea was too much. It killed civilians, and it caused the North Koreans to be so concerned about their people that they got angered at the United States, and that's why they hate us. That's completely ridiculous. I just have a few quotes. This is a book I'm reading by Max Hastings. He's a pretty famous British historian on the Korean War. And I just have a couple quotes, and... he's very well respected, very well researched, and about the air campaign, this is what he says. This is on page 269. No one could seriously dispute that to be bombed was a deeply distressing experience, and UN strategic bombing added greatly to the communists' difficulties in sustaining the war. But of all governments upon earth, those in Peking and Pyongyang were among the least likely to be deterred from continuing a commitment to the conflict merely because of the distress it caused to their peoples. The North Koreans and the Chinese deliberately used tactics in which they used the civilian population to shield their armies, and then they also would have the civilians kill Americans. There were many cases where Americans didn't take prisoners, they killed civilians. That's well documented. But most of these are after they saw American soldiers who who were surrendering or who were unarmed being killed by civilians. Just civilians with North Koreans come along and just kill the American troops. So what kind of environment are you forcing for the American soldiers there? They would just shoot civilians if they thought they were a threat to them. So it was a war of absolute brutality where both sides were fighting for victory. And unfortunately, the North Koreans and the Chinese used the civilians against the American troops, and so the American troops were forced to take action against them. So that's not America's fault, as much as we might not approve of their actions. I think they were, in some cases, they were left with no choice, or it's just a very difficult situation to be thrust into.
Well, if we contrast what the Washington Post said with what Max Hastings said, the Washington Post said that that their government, that the North Korean government actually cared a lot about the people, and that's why they fought back so hard. Well, and then Max Hastings said that North Korea actually cares less about its people than probably any nation in the entire world. Which one's correct, the historian or the person who is trying to write basically a propaganda piece supporting North Korea?
Yeah, well, I think it shows that the North Koreans saw their people as cannon fodder for the fatherland. And
They still do.
Yeah.
If you look at the way they're treated.
Yeah, it's just like the terrorists in the Middle East. They treat their children to become warriors to fight against their foe. They don't offer any other future for their children. And so it's just a system that creates generational violence. And I have this quote here I think summarizes her and destroys her point here. And this is talking about the brief period in 1950 when the North Koreans conquered almost all of South Korea. The Americans were pushed back before MacArthur got there. And this is what he writes. Because the South Korean government was very corrupt and they were authoritarian, but they were nothing compared to North Koreans. This is what he says. For many South Koreans, the process of discovering the meaning of communist liberation was extended through the 4 months that Kim Il-sung's army occupied their country. It is difficult to overemphasize the importance of this period in the subsequent history of Korea. In the years between 1945 and 1950, many of those living under the regime of Syngman Rhee were dismayed and disgusted by the corruption and injustice of the old president came to represent. For all the rumors filtering down from the North about land reform and political education, there seemed no reason to imagine that life under Kim Il-sung was any worse than under Syngman Rhee. The two victorious totalitarians appeared to have much in common. Even when the invasion came in June 1950, in the words of a young bank clerk's son, Ming Pyong-kyu, we still did not realize that this was a catastrophe for us. And he goes through and explains how when the North Koreans came, the South Koreans thought they were liberated from this terrible leader who was killing people and imprisoning people. He wasn't a freedom-loving man. But they quickly realized that was nothing compared to what the North Koreans did. North Koreans came in, they would murder whole families. In one case, there was a mass grave of about, I believe it was 1,300 people found. And that's just a small sample. They deliberately starve populations. They would beat people. And just most of the deaths of civilians in South Korea came at this time at the hands of their own people. It wasn't Americans bombing campaign or anything like that. It was the North Koreans before the Chinese entered the war. And so for as bad as it was, all the South Koreans immediately realized after a few days that Kim Il-sung was much worse. And that's the true face of communism. This is the origins of the regime. Kim Il-sung was trying to fall in the footsteps of Stalin, who told him to invade South Korea.
Right.
This is about the communist doctrine, and there's no way possible that you can justify or to say there's a kernel of truth in how they feel.
Unless you're communist.
Yeah.
Which is probably something to consider. But yeah, I mean, so, you know, when you look at that history, that should be presented and then say, well, what do you think? Do you think America should have taken a stand? You think America should have fought to stop somebody like that from taking over? Absolutely. It's so documented. Same thing happened in World War II. The Germans, why did they fight the Russians so hard? Because they were hoping to hold them off until America got there. Because they didn't want to fall into the Russian hands. They wanted to fall into the Americans' hands. Why? Because we were monsters? No, because we would be more humane and more civil with them than the communist side. It's so documented, and yet they try to tell you in this article that, well, there's some truth to what North Korea is doing. Are you kidding me? I can't believe that even went to press.
Well, the media really does try to paint America and really any Western democracy as the cause of all world evils today. And that's just, you do have to erase history to even claim that.
Yeah, it's unreal.
Well, the author, she's the Washington Times chief.
Washington Post?
Post? Okay, Washington Post.
Post is the liberal one.
Okay, yeah, it's their chief editor in Japan over there, that region there. So she's a quite prominent person there for their organization. And it's just astounding that they could justify that when you still have people living with the loss of that war. And then also, it's if we look at what those people in North Korea have gone through 70 years of the Sung's rule, of the communist rule, we should have done more to stop their regime. I mean, I think it's a great shame to America that war ended in a stalemate, because those people have gone through, we've allowed that regime to exist for many, many reasons. It's not simple, but we should have done more to end that regime. And there's very few wars where we're more justified than that in fighting a war for other people's freedom.
Yeah, that's really the issue. The shame isn't in the fact that we fought it. It's not we didn't fight it hard enough and win it.
Yeah.
Or the government didn't allow the soldiers to go in and do what they could have done.
Yeah.
Really an interesting time in which we live. That's all the time we have for today on Trumpet Radio Live, this weekend edition. Thanks for spending some time with us. Gia David program, Trumpet Daily Radio Show, and Trumpet Hour Week in Review coming up this weekend as well. For myself, Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon, Abraham Blondeau, have a great weekend. We'll talk to you Monday.
You're listening to Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG.